For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website. Good evening.
Good evening.
And especially welcome to the people who I have not met yet. Thank you for being here, and thanks to everybody for being here. I am Aishin Nancy Easton, to those who I don't know yet. And I wanted to just share some thoughts tonight. Basically around the topic of practicing non-harming. As probably many people know, I just came out of the sort of week of the Dharma transmission process with also my Dharma brother Nyozan Eric Schutt with our teacher Taegin. And you know, that was a week of like, it's a little bit like actually like being in a cocoon where, you know, where we were here in Ancient Dragon for a large portion of the day working on things. And, you know, and practicing in a very distilled and concentrated way. We were a lot, you know, kind of in our own world. And it was a joyous time, you know. We had a kind of a big celebration, especially yesterday, with the whole Sangha. And it was with a lot of shock and dismay that I, you know, emerged from my cocoon only to discover, to hear, you know, the news about the really horrible mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, that took place over the weekend. And it just was such a contrast with, you know, kind of my own personal joy that I was feeling. It was very, very sobering. And it just sort of brought my mind to thinking about, you know, violence and our tradition of practicing non-harming. And it raised questions for me of, you know, who do we practice for? Are we practicing for ourselves? Certainly we can derive a lot of peace of mind and comfort from practice. Not always because, you know, meditation is so peaceful, because it isn't always. You know, sometimes we're really sitting with a lot of difficult feelings and thoughts and situations, and I think actually it's more the process of being able to sit with and tolerate some of what comes up that brings that feeling of peace of mind. But are we really practicing just for ourselves, you know? And if there's no distinction between self and others, how are we practicing for others? You know, what is it that we can bring to others from our own practice? You know, how can we help the world? And I have a bunch of different thoughts about that, but I think it started with thinking about the paramitas, which are the, there's sort of a basic six, you know, paramitas, which are sort of the perfection practices that, you know, help to bring self and others, you know, across something to a place of more wholeness and more peace. There's the basic six, and then there are sort of the other four from the Mahayana tradition. And so we practice sometimes with qualities of generosity, ethical conduct, patience, energy or effort, meditation, wisdom. Those would be sort of the basic six. And there are, I think it helps actually to take each of those one by one, which I'm not going to do tonight. I'm just going to mention them. But we also have the other four paramitas are skillful means, which is the ability to discern what would be most helpful at any given time. Vow, the vows that we make for ourselves to bring benefit to the world, powers, and knowledge. And I think we can sometimes, you know, we practice with these qualities to cultivate them, but we wouldn't be able to do that if they weren't present in us to begin with, in some form, sometimes just a form that we can't even recognize in ourselves or in others, but we really are practicing to find things that, in fact, we already possess. When you sit for a while, you realize, you know, that when your mind calms down, you find that what's there under the surface of all these churning thoughts is something that was always there. And you could think about it as your presence of mind, your capacity to be awake, your capacity for, you know, compassionate wisdom. You could think about it as your Buddha nature. And I love I saw a quote from the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh a little while back, in which he talks about how, you know, when we first come to practice, we're all part-time Buddhas. Everybody has these qualities to some extent, but we lose sight of them, sometimes a lot, you know. Sometimes we forget them on a moment-to-moment basis. And as we practice, we try to get in touch with those qualities on a more consistent basis. You know, maybe we catch ourselves in a situation where we've lost our patience, or we didn't feel like being generous, and we sort of realize, okay, you know, how could I have been more skillful with that situation? And in that kind of reflection, we are actually honing our skills at letting our Buddha nature flourish in more and more situations. So, you know, we can all really forget to bring forth our own basic goodness, but then, you know, we can remind ourselves, and we can remind each other, and we can have that. The more we practice, the greater the likelihood that we'll have those moments of sort of like waking up and going, oh, okay, this is what's happening. And I thought it was some whole other thing that I either really wanted or really didn't want, but it's something else, you know. And so as we practice, we just sort of naturally develop a greater awareness of how all beings and all things are endowed with Buddha nature, just as Buddha promised in his statement when he awakened. So I want to propose something which may seem a little bit disturbing or radical on the surface. I want to propose, well, I mean, it's easy to say, you know, that all beings are endowed with Buddha nature. But it's hard when we think about the fact that that means that, you know, active shooters are endowed with Buddha nature. Gun freaks are endowed with Buddha nature. All the people that we think are misguided and deluded are all endowed with Buddha nature. And so, you know, how can that be? How can people be endowed with Buddha nature and do things that are really harmful? And I think this is a big question that we can, and a heavy and important question that we can practice with, is how can any of us, you know, have Buddha nature and yet act in ways that are so contrary to bringing, you know, tolerance and compassion and wisdom to our world? So I want to propose something else that may seem a little bit radical, but I want to just sort of propose the idea that, you know, as we reflect on the violence in our world, that we don't want to be a part of and we don't want to see, I think we also need to examine the violence within ourselves. You know, external violence is always preceded by internal violence. Internal violence doesn't always get to the point of being external violence, but external violence doesn't come from no place. You know, that comes from internal violence. So what do I mean by internal violence? What I mean is the ways in which we relate to ourselves. You know, maybe the ways in which we talk to ourselves, especially the ways in which we think about ourselves and others as good or bad. You know, we want to cling to what we think is good, and we want to, you know, turn away from or push away from the bad. And we do this all the time in very subtle ways. And that's where we can work on this within ourselves. You know, these subtle ways of thinking about people or thinking about situations seem pretty harmless. You know, they're just thoughts, right? You know, anytime we just throw up our hands and just say, okay, whatever, I'm done with that. I want to propose that that's the same kind of violent impulse that, when amplified by a lot, can turn into, you know, killing, which is one of the grave precepts that we've taken to not do. And so by the time, I also want to sort of think about, I think that by the time we get to the point where we're doing it in the external, it's a little bit too late. You know, you can't undo actions in a lot of cases, but we can work on our thoughts, you know, before we start to take action. So when we start to get into these very fixed views of, you know, that's good or that's bad, or those people are bad, that's where we need to start doing some work. And one of the things that I think is a helpful way to think about this, that somebody introduced me to a long time ago, is thinking about our judgments. And judgment is not a bad thing. We all have to make judgments all the time about things that are, you know, good or bad or right or wrong. But I think there are two ways of practicing judgment. And one is reflective judgment, where we observe something, and without getting all caught up in our emotionally laden thoughts about, you know, good or bad, when we're practicing reflective judgment, we can maybe spend some time seeing into the causes and conditions for how various qualities and events arise. You know, how if we're using reflective judgment about ourselves or maybe about another person, we can spend some time reflecting on what sequence of causes and conditions led that person to feel or think or act the way that they do, or, you know, with ourselves as well. And how can we look at that with eyes of trying to, you know, kindly understand, rather than to go into the other kind of judgment, which is the reflexive judgment, where we just use the reflex. It's like you're a judge with a gavel, and you're just saying, okay, that's good, that's bad, you know, bam, bam, bam. And we're just labeling and moving on. And we can start to feel like, especially, you know, that anyone who doesn't agree with our point of view is just bad. So we make, you know, these divisive comments on social media or among our friends or within our heads, and our thoughts, as we start to, you know, spin them up and identify with them, they really prevent us from being able to maintain that stance of compassionate inquiry that I like to call reflective judgment. So I have some questions for, you know, practice or for discussion. And I'm just really going to pose them in a general way. But one of the questions is, you know, can we, in any given situation, can we start to observe how some person or some situation has come to be as they are? You know, I have a number of friends who have views that are really, really different from my own, and sometimes it's really hard to listen to. They really genuinely believe that they are, you know, that the world is more safe when they can have their guns and you know, protect themselves, and it's sometimes just, you know, it's hard to sit with. They hold other, you know, views about people that I don't happen to hold, and I kind of take it as a challenge for myself to sort of, you know, listen and just try to understand, you know, how did they come to feel that way? And what I've discovered is that, you know, even when I think I know what's going on with somebody or how they, you know, how they came to be the way they are, I'm never fully free from my own self-centered view. You know, there's always room to be surprised, and you know, my friends with very, very different views from me, they have Buddha nature. You know, they care about they can be very caring towards their families, their children, their grandchildren, and so I know that there's something basic that we share, and so, you know, it's always an opportunity for me to try to understand, you know, okay, how can we, you know, what's contributed to this person seeming so totally different from me? Question two is, can we find ways through our own practice and through our own listening to talk to others in ways that help them hear our message rather than defend our views? We know we're in that negative space when we start defending our own views, you know, when other people start triggering us and we're like, no, you're wrong. And, you know, is there a way that we can, you know, work with our conversations so that we can take a step back before we get to that place where things are starting to get polarized? And question three, you know, is, can we study what helps us cultivate tolerance and compassion within ourselves and within others? You know, what helps me to cultivate compassion and tolerance maybe the same as what works with somebody else, and maybe it's not, and maybe that's something that we can study. But I want to propose that these kinds of practices really are how we all awaken together. I think that that's sort of the crux of our Mahayana tradition, is that we awaken together in dialogue around these things, and we can't leave anyone out. You know, like was it Snow White, where the fairy, you know, the one fairy wasn't invited to the baby's birthday party, and so was so angry that, you know, she then cast a spell on Snow White, and she was going to fall into a slumber for 1,000 years. And you know, I always think about that fairy, and who is that person in my, you know, in a given situation or in my life? Who am I excluding in such a way that, you know, it's gonna come back and create really challenging situations later? So in thinking about, you know, the violence that has just erupted, I don't have any specific answers for what any of us should do, but I do want to encourage us all to try to cultivate and help, and in ourselves and in others, you know, generosity, patience, ethical conduct, skillful means, wisdom, energy, meditation, knowledge, powers, vow, because those are the qualities that will help people from falling into a place where they need to act with such violence that friends and family are harmed. So maybe we can have a little discussion on this or about anything else. Thank you. I just realized I didn't see the clock. But I'd love to hear other people's thoughts on nonviolence and non-harming. So thank you for listening to me. Wait, hi.
Thank you for the talk. Yeah, I have a note on two bits of rhetoric that I've heard around the specific incidents. Incident that not certainly only this. One is that, of course, as with every time, it reignites the conversation about mental health. My personal view is that if we talk about people like this as having mental health disorders, it's one factually incorrect. Generally suggesting that. Too deeply offensive to people with mental health disorders. But three, I think it allows us in public discourse to say, oh, well, I don't have a mental health disorder, or this is a problem with a faction of society that has a diagnosable medical disorder and doesn't relate to culture or society as a whole. So it allows us to put these people as an other instead of saying that is us, just a tiny bit more. Mm-hmm. And the second point, which is really the same point, is I heard the mayor of Dayton on NPR today, who, as so many people have in situations like this before, referred to the shooter as pure evil, or something along those lines, which, again, I don't think is true or, for that matter, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it's easy to say something like that coming from a Judeo-Christian background, which tends to deal a little more heavily in absolutes and is more invested in ideas of good and bad with capital letters, good and evil. Capital letters, whereas our tradition doesn't have that focus. But I, again, think it's not true. I don't know, I couldn't point to something in the world that's purely good or purely evil. Mm-hmm. And I think it allows us to disavow our own responsibility for the parts of us that participate in evil, in addition to parts of participating in, and quite frankly dehumanizes this other person who also had good in him.
Mm-hmm.
Though he was obviously not expressing that in the moment. But if we say that someone is purely good or purely evil, then they're no longer human, and it no longer is a human problem to engage with at an interpersonal level and to do the hard work to solve. So it allows us to not have to practice.
Mm-hmm.
To not say that, oh, this too is us. And not just us as a society, but me, as like, wait, even that is also me. Just with the volume turned up a little bit. Right? And so that the work to solve society of that particular pill is the work that I have to do to solve my stuff. Yeah. Of that, that it's not different than speaking in absolutes or in terms of mental health disorders is not a way to actually engage with the issue, but to try to come up with an easy fix to something that's inside.
Yeah. I agree. I liked what you were saying about not making an other, you know, because actually, for, you know, the person who pulled the trigger in either of these situations, it is actually too late. But one thing we know almost for sure, given our past historical experience, is that there's somebody else out there who, you know, is about three bad decisions away from creating another situation. And until that happens, it's not too late for that person. And so it does beg the question of, you know, how can we reach others? You know, how do we help other people, you know, kind of pull back from that impulse and get themselves to a place where they're able to work with the anger and pain and you know, greed, hate, and delusion.
And it's also possible, maybe we're not three bad decisions, right? Maybe we're 30 or 300.
Yeah.
But there's not an absolute barrier.
Yeah. There's not an absolute number of bad decisions.
There's not an infinite number of bad decisions.
Yeah.
It's a finite number, right? For any
person. I was just doing it to match Chris.
All beings arise together.
Maybe it's symmetry.
Okay, rock, paper, scissors.
Well, I mean, I was just reminded of a James Baldwin quote that I won't be able to like recite it verbatim, but it's something like what you just mentioned, that kind of, and he was referencing specifically like white supremacy and like letting go of that ideology is so difficult because then one would have to, or white people will have to like deal with kind of the pain, the pain that's behind it, you know? And it's such a powerful insight into, and so empathetic for a black man to assert that. But I feel like that's really true, and it kind of relates to so much of what we practice, and that recognition of Buddha nature is a recognition of shared suffering and shared pain. And, you know, in some ways, we feel, maybe I feel lucky that I didn't attach to an ideology like that that would somehow master that. I'm like lucky to kind of find a practice that helps me face that suffering and so forth. So maybe that's that reaching out of like there, you know, like the Four Noble Truths. There is a way, you know. And
great point. Yeah.
To do that without like, you know, going on a street corner and, you know, preaching or whatever, but to embody that or whatever that means, I'm not sure, but that Baldwin quote I think is you know, really captures that the situation for people, I think.
Yeah, a lot of violence or, you know, sort of supremacy of any kind is a cover up for feelings of inferiority, really, and and pain and shame and
I'm really glad that you, well, first of all, thank you very much for your talk. It was just really, really appreciated. The Baldwin quote is really applicable for what I was thinking in the same way. Another thing that he often talks about is this collective responsibility, and you touched on this too many times as well, that we all share this burden, but we we all are part of it. We're not separate from each other. And so we all collectively hold this responsibility. And I think that often people, as you were saying, maybe when you talk about somebody being pure evil as a way of creating an other there in order to create a me or cure this good. There's no one that's to be evil. Even the person pulling the trigger doesn't think that they're evil or bad. And so I think it's really important to acknowledge this responsibility. Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about interbeing, which I think is a wonderful word that he uses a lot. He mentions over and over again this phrase that that is because this is, or that is the way that it is because this is the way it is. And often I have a lot of trouble internalizing that, that I try to do my very best, trying to be as well raised as possible for the kind and all of these things, but, and so I think, how could I have anything to do with mass shootings in Texas, but it's bigger than just me thinking about the little individual things that I'm doing. It's this collective action that's going on. No matter what is going on here is happening because of what's happening in part over here. And so how can we think about ways in which the I and all of them, whatever, affect that culture of violence and hate throughout the day? And that may be very, very minor things in relation to our coalitions and stuff. Throughout the day, what are small ways in which we see this culture of violence being reified throughout the day? That, when I was crossing the street today and someone was trying to go to the point where it stops, I just wanted to be so angry with them. And how could that, if I had gone to that person, what ways, even the way that I feel justified, could continue this culture of anger? You see very, very little in Chicago, which is this tension of people looking at the world. I'm justified in being mad and angry at these other people, cutting them off, or whatever. You're not thinking about it. It's bigger than that. And every minuscule choice, even internally, that I make throughout the day, cannot help but send that out in all directions and ripples forever. And so this kind of responsibility that we have in every single individual moment, will we help perpetuate a culture of violence, and where will we help try to dissolve that and try to do it in a way that is still. So I'd like to think about
that. Thank you. We really have to work to be impeccable with our speech, actions, thoughts. We chanted the All My Ancient Twisted Karma born through body, speech, and mind. It's right there to practice with. I was talking with a few people yesterday about bicycle commuting, and we were kind of talking about how, especially in the beginning when you first start riding a bicycle in traffic, you're just so anxious. It really wears off after a while, that feeling of vulnerability. But in the beginning, you feel so vulnerable, and you're just so anxious that I remember just being so aggressive and, yelling at people. And once I was able to calm down with it and, in many cases just slow down, it doesn't bring up the same sort of response anymore, and I think that's helpful. I agree with you. I don't think it's helpful when we start yelling at people who almost hit us out of an accident.
And of course, I should say this, this starts at home as well. But I also feel a very intense self anger and loathing that way. It's kind of a
Yeah, well, we for sure need to cultivate it for ourselves. Yeah. And receive it. Yeah.
Something that somebody said reminded me of that book by Truman Capote, In Cold Blood. And the young man that went into that farmhouse and killed the family, it was really interesting that Truman Capote got this out of him, that when he walked up to the father in the family, and the father was tired, he was scared. And the killer was so ashamed of himself when he saw the fear in this good man. He didn't know what to do. And it was a shame that just overwhelmed him when he did that. I thought that was the most interesting thing in a crime book that I've read. And I also wanted to talk about backstories, because backstories are extremely entertaining, and I didn't ever see Wicked, but it's the backstory on the Wicked. But I did go see the production of, and so I moved from fact, from, you know, nonfiction to fiction. But I did see the production of Jesus Christ Superstar with the literary, and it was, you know, nobody interprets this the way I do, and it's kind of disconcerting, because Jesus Christ Superstar in that production was the backstory on Judas. And it was very, very interesting to me that Andrew Lloyd Webber, I think he was 19 or 20 or 21 when he wrote that, that he, I don't know how, you know, who contributed to it, but he is the one who gets the credit for having this insight into what happened to Judas. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a really, really, really interesting interpretation of the whole story. And then there's others like White Sargasso Sea, which is the backstory of the woman in the attic from Bronte. And it's written by a genius, but it starts with her story and how she got to be that mad woman in the attic. And these things are just, to me, fiction or fact, they're very, very, very interesting.
People are so complex. People are so complex.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. What a. I think I just want to, before I move on, I just want to say how moving that is to think that, you know, someone, your story about in Cold Blood, you know, someone responds to us as if we're someone to be feared, and it fills us with a feeling that turns us into someone to be feared.
Pardon me?
And it fills us with such a feeling of shame that we become someone to be feared. You know, we act on that.
There's
and
shame.
Yeah,
shame.
Yeah.
The shame is what caused him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the guy was a really good guy. I think he was a father, farmer, four children, you know, outstanding citizen and all that. And when this young man approached him, he was afraid.
Yeah. It's funny how we don't necessarily recognize the impact that the way that we, you know, are perceiving someone can maybe have on them too.
Can I
yeah.
just one
Yeah, sure.
This is a true story. I'm not going to tell it very well. But it was about a woman, and she called her son and said, "I had just been attacked. But the person who attacked her was a murderer. He was a serial killer. And somehow or other, she got talking to him. And at some point she said to him, 'You're hurting me.' And he walked away. And he had killed other people before that, and he was intending to kill her, but she somehow, because she got a chance to communicate with him, he walked away from her.
That's like the story of the Buddha and Angulimala, who was a serial killer who was coming after Buddha. And Buddha handled it a little bit differently. You know, Buddha kept sort of walking away, and the killer said, you know, hey, stop. And then Buddha said, you know, I have stopped. You're the one who needs to stop. But that way of interacting and you know, totally can transform a situation.
When we were talking about the whole El Paso type thing, I have a friend who was in El Paso when that happened. She was texting children at the mall, but she had a friend who worked there. I guess thinking about all this about someone who's out there, it is very easy to like demonize them and just kind of write it off as like, oh, they're not human. But part of me, and I don't speak from my perspective, I don't know how to look at other people, like, you know, depend on them, but it almost feels like it's like a cheating to just call them, like, you know, this unholy thing. Because, like, when we all think about it, like, if we were in their shoes, like, in my mind, like, that could have easily been, like, anybody. At least for me, just
yeah.
Because it's, when you take away, like, what, like, labels we call ourselves, social security cards, and, you know, our... You know, we leave our likes and dislikes and who we really are as people, like, there's not a lot to differ. So, I guess learning from that, what I took away was just learn to, I guess, be more patient, not only with other people, but more or less with yourself, with those other people, just because, like, it's usually when we make the mistakes that it's either, you know, like she said, the shame, or just the overwhelming not knowing what to do that leads us to like act on these bad intuitions.
Yeah, yeah. We're always human beings all the way through it. Yeah, that's I think a really important point is to just always remember that we're them and they're us and it's easier, I think, to do for, you know, when we're not right there. I feel for your friend because it's hard to calm down. You know, the closer you get to a situation like that, I think the harder it is to calm down. And it's a lot easier to reflect on things when we're feeling calm. But I hope your friend is okay.
She is.
Yeah. One last comment, Dylan?
Yeah. This has been a wonderful conversation. I think the bravery of friendship is so important. And I think at the root of a lot of what we're talking about. The scenario that's making me think of is there was a couple of years ago there was somebody who was getting out of a car. They were in an Uber and the Uber driver was driving really nice and they almost got hurt. Like they were trying to get out of the car but the person like started speeding up as they were trying to get out of the car or something. And there was going to be a conflict. Like the people that are trying to get out of the car were trying to, like, you know, either attack or confront this driver in some way. Somebody went up to the guy that had gotten out of the car and they were about to, like, you know, have a conflict with the driver and just asked him, you know, are you okay? Like, are you okay? You know? And kind of like one of the stories you were alluding to, Jan, like the ability to, when that boiling point is happening, for somebody to be there to affirm that, you know, like to take the scenario and bring it down to like I value you being alive and that you're healthy, that you're okay. Like, is that the case? And then once that person kind of was able to say, like, oh yeah, no, I am okay, then the situation kind of transformed a little bit, and it became less about attacking this guy and more like, you know, you kind of lose your rationality when the boiling point sort of happens. So, and that's a particular, like, climactic expression of that, like, on a day-to-day basis, our ability to cultivate brave friendship with each other, you know, to help guide each other through how difficult it is to be alive in America in 2019, I think is a really invaluable way of helping to avoid these types of things happening. I would not be shocked at all if any of these shooters did not have, it felt like they were completely alone.
Yeah.
Or that nobody understood them.
Yeah.
Or that they were, or that there's nobody cared about them, and that they were erased from meaning in some way, and that was how they were going to achieve meaning in some ways, or achieve, or at least let everybody know how angry they were,
yeah,
and how they didn't mean anything anymore. So friendship is a way of fighting against that.
That's great. We all can go astray in a vacuum. You know, even positive things can go completely awry when we don't, work with others with other perspectives. But I love the concept of brave friendship. That would make a wonderful talk. So, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for a thoughtful, thought-provoking conversation.